Will you please call the case?
Case number SCWC-13-69, State v. Reed. Arguing for the petitioner is Craig W. Jerome. No. Arguing for the respondent, Sonia P. McCulley. Also, argument on the merits.
Good morning. Good afternoon. That's the first time we've had an afternoon argument in some time. Good afternoon, Mr. Jerome and Ms. McCullen. Are you both ready to proceed today with your argument? All right. And Mr. Jerome, you've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll give you a yellow light with 5 minutes to go. And Ms. McCullen, we'll give you a warning with 5 minutes left to go in your argument. So please proceed. Thank you.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I'm Deputy Public Defender Craig Jerome, appearing on behalf of petitioner, appellant, defendant Kaika Reed in this case. I want to thank the court for agreeing to hear Mr. Reed's case and also for allowing me to argue on his behalf this afternoon. As the court's aware, we presented one question to this honorable court in our application for writ of certiorari. That was whether the ICA gravely erred in holding that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in denying Mr. Reed's motion for withdrawal and substitution of counsel in this case. This single question raises significant and far-ranging concerns related to a non-indigent criminal defendant's most fundamental rights to assistance of counsel, due process, and a fair trial. The circuit court's denial of Mr. Reed's motion reflected a single-minded focus on the court's preferred schedule and an unreasonable inflexibility about modifying it. The circuit court displayed a short-sighted insistence on expeditiousness in the face of a justifiable request for delay in this case. In so doing, the circuit court treated Mr. Reed's right to counsel as an empty formality, abused its discretion, and reversibly erred.
Mr. Jerome, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but could you address the circuit court's view that the defendant's position was a dilatory one?
Thank you, Justice Wilson. And that's the single finding that the court made in this case, was that this was a dilatory tactic. And, you know, unfortunately, the circuit court didn't explain its reasoning in reaching that conclusion in any way. There appears to be no support in the record for that conclusion.
Well, how about the failure to file a motion between the last trial call and the morning of the hearing? There were a couple of days in between there. Is that something that you think the court could properly take into account as supporting its finding of lack of diligence?
Well, and respectively, the court didn't find that there was a lack of diligence. The court just found it was a delay tactic. Mr. Reed did, on October 10th, move for a continuance in this case for two reasons. First was because his counsel wasn't prepared to proceed to trial, and second, because he was, you know, exploring the possibility of potentially retaining substitute counsel.
Mr. Jerome, wasn't a representation also made that he was trying to find some witnesses?
Yes.
Wasn't that representation made also at the pretrial hearing?
Yes.
Shouldn't the, understandably the court didn't make any findings, but if the trial counsel doesn't say anything about, we've been trying to find witnesses, but we haven't been able to, or they kind of just made this, one said the attorney was trying to do it, then they said Mr. Reed was trying to do it, but it just seemed that it was this amorphous find witnesses, but not anything substantive as to what the witnesses would, except they did say they were present at the time of the offense, right?
Yes, the representation that was made on the 10th was that Mr. Reed was in the process of attempting to find witnesses to testify on his behalf. And, you know, based on what's in the record, I'm not sure whether the public defender knew of specific witnesses or Mr. Reed was still trying to come up with contact information. What we do know, however, is that on October 11th, the public defender, deputy public defender, filed a witness list that named three civilian witnesses. And then on October 16th, during the midst of trial, all of a sudden, Mr. Reed showed up with four witnesses to testify on his behalf, three of whom were not on that witness list, and apparently the deputy public defender spoke to some of them the night before and met the other ones for the first time that day. So it's clear that the defendant is in the process of trying to find witnesses, and he, in fact, found witnesses between October 10th and October 15th or 16th to testify on his behalf. And that's one of the complaints he makes on the 15th when he explains why he wishes to seek substitute counsel is, you know, I told my attorney that I have like 10 witnesses and he never called my witnesses. He didn't call my witnesses until 2 days before the last trial call.
In fact, he had to get the state's agreement to put on those witnesses because he hadn't even notified the government of those witnesses during trial.
That's correct. He had, it was sort of in the midst of trial, these witnesses showed up and they dealt with it as best as they could.
Let me ask you something. There's been this reference about the deputy public defender notifying the court that Mr. Reed was in the process of potentially retaining other counsel. Now, at that time, didn't Mr. Reed have private counsel for his other case?
He had private counsel, yes, in the existing terroristic threat.
So Michael Green was representing him. So we already have a situation where he's being represented by private counsel in another case, correct?
Yes.
And I believe bail, at least in this case, was something like $40,000.
Yes.
And he had posted bail.
Yes, he was out on bail in both cases, actually.
So this is someone who already has established an ability to have money available, at least to be able to hire private counsel, at least in one case, and to post bail in both cases. Is that correct?
Yes.
And when a statement was made about potentially retaining other counsel, what was the judge's response or inquiry when that representation was made?
The judge didn't make any inquiry on October 10th as far as anything to do with potentially retaining other counsel.
No questions about it.
No questions about why or when or who he'd spoken to or if he had actually retained private counsel or when private counsel could become available or if I continued this until Friday, could you come in with a new attorney? No, it just wasn't addressed at all. The witness issue was addressed, but the issue of private counsel wasn't addressed at all.
Didn't he come up with a different private counsel, though?
Different than the counsel who represented him in the terroristic threatening case, but okay. You know, that could be for any number of reasons. The point, the thing is, on October 15th, on the day of trial, he shows up with an attorney who he's retained, at least provisionally, under the agreement that I'll take your case if the case gets continued.
But shouldn't that, I'll come back to my question, and you know, whether it be through a motion to continue or a motion to substitute counsel or both, should why couldn't the court take into account the fact that there had been no motion filed at the end of the prior week to that effect, even though I believe there were at least a couple of work days in the end of that week?
Well, I think the court could take that into consideration, but there's no indication on the record that the court did take that into consideration. And realistically speaking, if the trial call is on Wednesday, we don't know, because it was never asked of the defendant when he actually formally retained Mr. Kimoto. When we know that, based on Mr. Kimoto's representations, that he first spoke to the defendant the Tuesday before the trial call, but you know, maybe the defendant went in and said, well, I'll get a continuance, and after the continuance, I'll be able to retain Mr. Kimoto or somebody else. The continuance is denied, and now the defendant is left to kind of scramble to hire an attorney before Monday when the trial is going to begin. We don't know what the defendant's schedule is like. We don't know if the defendant works. Just because there's two business days in there where potentially somebody could have filed a motion for substitution and withdrawal, you know, I don't know that necessarily that should be held against the defendant. I'm sorry, Justice Wilson.
Mr. Jerome, nonetheless, the circuit court judge was faced with a situation where she hadn't received a motion. Trial was about to begin, and it appears from the record that it was really about to begin because it was a time when a jury was waiting. A jury had been summoned. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So can you speak to the extent to which that factor is at issue, the one in Kramer that focuses on the efficient administration of the courts?
I think that that's a factor that certainly that can be considered, but the court seemed to have treated that as the only factor that was to be considered. In fact, the court in this entire hearing asked three questions. The first two questions he asked where he asked Mr. Kimoto, if I grant this motion, are you prepared to proceed today? And then he asked him, when was the first time that Mr. Reed contacted you? Those were the only two questions he asked of Mr. Kimoto. He didn't ask how long a continuance he was requesting. He didn't ask if we push this back to the end of the week. Everyone knew this was basically a two-day trial. And in fact, at one of the prior proceedings, the court said, you know, well, maybe we can start this trial on Monday and do another trial on Thursday. He never inquired, if I push this trial back to Thursday, would you be prepared to go to trial? He never asked. And I'm sorry.
I appreciate your point about how it appeared from the discussions in the record that perhaps there could have been a trial with the backup case, or perhaps this case could have been delayed somewhat because it was a short case. But you are focusing now on the efficient administration of justice, the courts, however you want to define that factor in Kramer, and you're focusing now on the scheduling of the trial, the inconvenience perhaps to the judge or to the jury. Is there any other factor that should be considered when you're defining efficient administration of justice? Is something other than the calendar or the scheduling requirements of the court and the jury?
Well, I think the court should have inquired about what the state's position was with regard to the motion.
Well, they didn't object, right?
They didn't object, no. I mean, there was no objection. They just sort of took no position.
So you're suggesting that in considering the efficient administration of the court, that it's not only the court schedule that's considered, but also what effect it might have on the parties?
The effect on the prosecution, the effect on the prosecution's witnesses. If this is a case where there are mainland witnesses that have been flown out specially, if this is a case where there's multiple defendants and multiple attorneys whose schedules are being juggled, and one of the most important considerations in Kramer is whether current court-appointed counsel is ready to proceed or not. And it's not entirely clear from the record whether or not the deputy public defender in this case was prepared to proceed to trial, because he made representations on the 10th that he, in fact, wasn't prepared to proceed to trial. And the court basically said, 3 months after the public defender had been appointed, look, you've run out of time to prepare. We're going forward next week with this trial no matter what. And the court stuck to that. And significantly, the court was ready to rule after asking Mr. Kimoto two questions and like I said, the things he didn't ask Mr. Kimoto are significant. He was ready at that point to deny the motion, and then the public defender interjects and asks if Mr. Reed can make a statement about the reasons why he's seeking substitute counsel. One of the most important considerations in this case is, why did Mr. Reed want substitute counsel? And one of the things that doesn't exist in Kramer, there was no complaint about the representation of current counsel. In this case, Mr. Reed came up with several facially valid reasons why he was displeased with the public defender's representation, and the court didn't explore those at all. I mean, Mr. Reed basically said, I'm not satisfied with Mr. Ting's preparation or diligence in this case. He's not communicating with my witnesses. He's not communicating with me. He hasn't completed a thorough investigation. And the court just sort of dismissed that out of hand. And significantly, the court didn't even make itself informed of what those reasons were before it was ready to rule.
It seems as if the court, it didn't mention the case it was relying on, but it seemed like the court was relying on, I think it's Torrey's, where the attorney substitutes the same day. And I think the Chief Justice in Kramer said, look, that's a whole different issue, because in that case, it was an ineffective assistance, a counsel issue. And in that case, the lawyer had been permitted actually substituted, and they forced the lawyer to go the same day. This, there was never a substitution. So that case didn't even apply that the court relied on.
Yeah, I think that may be the case the court was relying on. I mean, the court says there's precedent, there's a case that's on point where, you know, basically the court says, you know, I look with disfavor on motions to substitute on the eve of trial, which is, interestingly enough, the exact same language the court used in denying the October 10th motion for continuance was, I look with disfavor on motions to continue made on the eve of trial. And the court, you know, I don't know if the court neglected to realize the difference between substitution of appointed counsel versus substitution of retained counsel, that it didn't have to find that there actually was some ineffectiveness or some lack of preparation. I mean, I think what's important in this case is Mr. Reed, at least based on his representations, was displeased with the quality of the counsel that he was receiving from the public defender's office.
Mr. Jerome, let me just ask you about that. Is it, do you feel comfortable arguing that issue here today? I mean, Mr. Ting is a fellow deputy in your office, correct?
Yes.
And you're being asked, in essence, because this issue has been raised, are you flagging it for us but not taking a position with regard to the quality of his representation? I'm trying to understand the position that you're, where you are on that issue.
No, I'm not saying that Mr. Ting was ineffective in this case. What I'm saying is that the defendant raised a facially valid reason for substituting his counsel, and the trial court, in exercising its discretion, didn't acknowledge or entertain or delve any further into that situation at all.
So you're not conceding in any way that there was any ineffectiveness. What you're asking is, or what you're suggesting is, that the court's failure to inquire was the problem with what occurred here. Is that, I'm just trying to understand your argument.
Yes. Okay. And, you know, and I think that if there was a real conflict between Mr. Ting and the defendant, no number of countervailing considerations could overcome that. And there's only one countervailing consideration in this case that was addressed. I'm sorry, Justice.
Why was the backup case, the TT case, continued to February on October 10th?
What's said on the record on October 10th is that the court instructed Mr. Green to file a motion to continue because the court wanted to take care of this case before the other case so that perhaps this case could resolve the other case. So, you know, I don't have the motion for continuance in that case. And
so there was no reason pertaining to that actual case. It's not that Mr. Green said he was not ready to proceed.
I don't know because I don't have the motion for continuance, but that's what came out during when the state didn't object to the motion for continuance in that case. That was the representation.
So Mr. Green was there at the trial call also?
Someone was there on Mr. Green's behalf.
I see.
Another attorney was standing in.
And do you know what ultimately the trial status was of the backup case? Did it go to trial?
I don't believe that case went to trial. I think it was resolved by plea. But, you know, like I said, that's not in the record in this case.
Do you think the defendant has an unqualified right to private counsel of his choice?
I don't think the defendant has. We acknowledge the defendant does not have a right to private counsel of his choice. He has a qualified right to private counsel of his choice. And that I think he has a presumptive right to counsel of his choice. And I think that the precedent makes it clear that trial courts have to recognize a presumption in favor of the defendant's right to counsel of choice.
This is a pretty significant constitutional right to counsel of your choice. Hasn't it been recognized?
I think it's among the most significant constitutional rights because it strikes at the very heart of what it means to be someone's representative.
A couple of the advantages, I think, that have been pointed out is that it allows the defendant to have confidence in the system, regardless of the result, that the defendant is about to choose their counsel. And it also obviously enhances the trust relationship. And it would seem to me that the balancing, it has to be a pretty significant, I mean, we use the term countervailing. It has to be a very significant reason to overcome that right.
And I think that's correct. And while there may have been countervailing considerations in this case, they weren't addressed by the court. And I don't think they were considered by the court based on just what the court said in denying the motion. I think the court decided this case is going to trial. I mean, the court says that. The court says the court wanted to start trying these cases. The court told everyone last week that these cases were going to trial. The case is going to trial today, regardless of what Mr. Reed's desire to exercise his right to counsel of choice.
At the time the court made that decision, do you think that it had before it any information that indicated that the defendant needed additional time to actually prepare a defense? Any specific information?
Well, the court had the information that was provided to the court on October 10th, which is, you know, sort of minimal at best, but, you know, I want to emphasize this is a case that...
Well, and how would you describe that evidence?
That evidence is that the defendant was trying to find witnesses to testify on his behalf, and the court inquired with Mr. Ting about what witnesses had been provided and what those witnesses were going to testify to, but significantly the court never asked the defendant, you know, do you know of specific witnesses? What are you still looking for? Is it that you don't know their addresses or their phone numbers? Do you not know their contact information?
And you raise a good point about the extent to which the court had an obligation to inquire further after it was given. I mean, it appeared that the parties had an opportunity at least to make their points about what additional evidence was needed, right? Because there was some discussion about that from the defendant as well as some discussion from defense counsel. So you felt that it's your position that the court was obligated to inquire further?
Are we talking about on the 10th or the 15th? I'm sorry.
I'm speaking about the 15th.
On the 15th, I think once the defendant presents a facially valid reason for seeking substitution of counsel, the court's obligated to inquire further to determine whether or not, if the court's going to make a finding that this is just a delay tactic, I think the court needs to apprise itself of facts and evidence in order to make that determination.
Is there anything in the record to indicate that it looks like delay? I mean, that's usually the primary consideration is delay. And is there anything in this case that points to intentional delay?
Not as far as I can tell. I mean, the defendant had never sought substitution of counsel before. There's no evidence that the court points to or the state points to or anybody else has been able to point to show that the defendant has a history of gaming the system or trying to get one over. The defendant asked for a continuance on October 10th, not on the day of trial. That is denied, and the defendant goes out and comes back with retained counsel. If the defendant was seeking to delay, I don't know if he'd go to the step of actually retaining counsel and bringing him to court with him on the day of trial.
And the two prior delays, one was because the government hadn't gotten the closing report and the grand jury transcript hadn't been received, and then the second delay, the defense had a witness that died and the government had three new witnesses, right?
Basically, the first two continuances in this case were basically stipulated continuances that were necessitated because of discovery issues. And I think it's interesting, you know, this case happened on June 10th of 2012 was the date of the incident. The public defender's office was appointed on July 5th of 2012. The trial started on October 15th of 2012, so that's a little bit over 12 weeks later. The state, as of September 26th, was still coming up with new witnesses. The police who testified at trial acknowledged that there were probably dozens of people present during this incident. They were only able to take statements from two witnesses. The defendant represented that he had like 10 witnesses he wanted defense counsel to talk to. So I really think this is a case that was rushed to trial. And I think it was rushed to trial based on the fact that the court wanted this trial to happen before the trial in the other case.
Well, then, Mr. Jerome, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but Justice Pollack had mentioned the importance of delay in considerations under Kramer as to whether a substitution should be allowed. When you look at the factors in Kramer, do you have a sense of priority about them at all? Is there a factor that stands out to you as any more important than the others?
I'll tell you, I think that they're all important. I think one of the factors that's missing from Kramer is the reason for substitution of counsel. I think that that's probably the primary reason that's missing from Kramer, and it wasn't an issue in Kramer because there was no reason given for substitution of counsel. But as I said, I think if the reason for substitution of counsel is valid, then no amount of countervailing considerations should really overcome that. As far as the reasons that are there, you know, whether current court-appointed counsel is prepared to proceed is obviously significant. You know, I think that they're all important, and notably in this case, the court really didn't take any steps to apprise itself of what any of these factors were. The court never so much as inquired about what the length of continuance was that was being requested, and I think the reason why the court didn't inquire was because no length of continuance would have been acceptable to the court. The case was going to trial that day.
Is there anything on the record to suggest that the court even checked with jury pool to see if there was another court that could take these jurors?
No, there's nothing. And, you know, based on the timing of the motion, the court was in court for the entirety of the motion. I don't know when the court was first made aware that this motion was pending. Or
when you look at the factors of Kramer, which one do you think includes consideration of whether the defendant needed time to prepare the defense?
I think whether current court-appointed counsel is prepared to proceed takes that into consideration. I'm sorry, Justice Falk, did you have a question?
I did.
Sorry.
Well, I think my time is up, so I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, and if you think of the question again, I'll be happy to address it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jarrell. Ms. McCullen.
May it please the court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Sonia McCullen on behalf of the State of Hawaii. As to defense's comment that dilatory was the court's only basis for denial of the motion, I don't think that's entirely accurate. The court made some other findings in its denial, but before I reach those, I want to point out that Kramer did not exist. Kramer opinion did not exist at the time the court made its denial. Kramer came out 6 months later, and there was no kind of laundry list for countervailing government interests at that time for the court to articulate. But the court did consider other factors like timeliness. The court mentioned eve of trial. Court also considered whether new counsel was ready to proceed or not.
With respect to this eve of trial issue, you say in your answering brief that the record, however, does not reflect any attempt by Reed to request substitution of counsel and continuance of the trial prior to the day trial was scheduled to commence. That's actually not accurate, is it?
There was no motion prior to, no.
Your statement is that the record does not reflect any attempt by Reed to request substitution of counsel and continuance of the trial prior to the day trial was scheduled to commence. On October 10th, there was an oral request to continue the trial and substitute counsel, was there not?
I think it was just an oral request to continue.
But you say, represent to this court, that there was no attempt whatsoever.
I apologize if that was incorrect.
Thank you.
May I ask you about the eve of trial?
Yes.
And obviously that's a, you know, administration of justice, it would seem to me, is certainly one of the most important factors. And I look at it at pretty much as the other half of the coin with dilatoriness. In other words, is the intentional delay impacting the way the courts are able to process the cases? My concern is whether or not that impact on the administration of justice gets enhanced. In other words, the impact gets enhanced because what occurs is the jury is present, but the jury is present because, in part, it would appear that when the court was notified, look, my client is potentially going to be hiring counsel. And again, this is a situation where somebody already has counsel in one case, it's posted a bail, obviously has financial means. And the court, instead of saying, okay, I'm going to continue this till Friday, we'll see the status, I'm going to have some sort of hearing to see if I'm going to put a deadline when your client can hire. Instead of doing that, it's all denied. The jury is ordered to appear on Monday, so of course we have an impact on the process because of the way the initial address or the initial time it's brought to the court's attention, the court doesn't even address it.
On the October 10th, yes, the court didn't address the defendant's statement that he's potentially possibly looking for another counsel. The court did not address that, no.
Ms. McCauley, did the court at any time on the 10th or the 15th of October indicate that if the case had to be put over, how many months it would have to be put over?
No, there was no indication in the record, but the defendant or the new defense counsel did indicate that he did not interview the defendant yet. He did not interview any of a number of witnesses yet. So there is some inference there that it could be somewhat of a delay.
You know, what Mr. Jerome kind of related to us about the time sequence, they've already stipped to two continuances. That doesn't count towards the Rule 48 time, right?
No, I believe no.
So, and it goes to trial in very short order. I mean, I don't even know if I've ever, except for in circuit court, seen. So, is there any indication what was the rush in this particular case? I mean, sure, the jury's been trial, but as has been pointed out, even from October 10th, the court is saying it's going to go to trial. And I understand the court wanted it to go to trial before the February, but there's still like 4 months between October and February.
Correct. There may be some indication, and if in this case I would request that this court take judicial notice of its records and Mr. Reed's terroristic threatening case. The two cases were kind of going in hand. In Mr. Reed's terroristic threatening case, if this court does take judicial notice, the defendant on the day of trial call.
Is this in the record?
No.
It's not in the record.
No. Should we just leave it at that then?
If it's not in the record, I guess you've asked us to take judicial notice of that other matter, but not in your briefs. And
no, I did not.
It's what you were about to allude to is in a transcript, correct? Not
yes,
within a record or file. Okay.
Well, the terroristic threatening case is referred to in the transcripts, but the actual record of the cases are not in this record.
All right.
Or of the terroristic threatening case is not in this record.
If I could ask you, Ms. McCollum, following up on what Justice Nakayama was asking about what's the rush, your colleague in this case at the time of trial was facing a situation in which there had been a couple of continuances that the government had agreed to, and at least one of them the government had caused for good reason. And in addition to that, your colleague was about to start a case that's fairly serious, right? This is an assault one. Ultimately, the defendant received 10 years with a 3-year, 4-month mandatory minimum. So the prosecutor at trial could see this was a pretty serious case. Had a defendant who didn't just request continuance to get his attorney, he actually had his attorney there, so the prosecutor could see that. There were ongoing discussions about the need for additional witnesses. This is an assault case where it's often fact-driven, where witnesses are important, right? So seeing all this, perhaps your colleague decided it probably wouldn't necessarily be a good idea to insist on moving forward because maybe the case would go up on appeal and it could be an issue and maybe it's not necessary to avoid it. So I am mentioning this analysis to you to just get your response, because maybe something happened at the trial level that suggested the prosecutor, I know the prosecutor said it could proceed, but it didn't seem there was any objection made. Prosecution didn't indicate that it was going to do anything that would pertain to the Kramer factors in terms of a problem for the prosecution. And then finally, with respect to the Kramer factors, if you consider the idea of it being dilatory, well, in Kramer, that was a point that I think was pointed out by the court, that in Kramer, if there was no indication it was dilatory. And in this case, maybe your colleague didn't think it was going to be dilatory since the prosecutor's office didn't say so. So given that, would you think that perhaps, at least at the trial level, the prosecutor wasn't concerned about there being a continuance?
That's not evident from the record. The prosecutor indicated that he was ready to go. It appears that the prosecution had all its witnesses lined up. I'm not sure I could say that the prosecutor at the time, and the record doesn't indicate.
Well, all right, thank you, but what about this was dilatory? Why do you think the judge found it was dilatory, given the way that the continuances had taken place and the fact that the defense attorney actually appeared with an attorney?
I think the court made clear that this case was going to go. The court also made clear that defendant's reasons for wanting to continue because he was still looking for witnesses. The court said he had plenty of time to do that. The court also...
When did the government get all their witnesses?
I don't know.
Well, didn't, looks like to me, on September 20th, and we're talking just weeks before the trial date, the government came up with two new witnesses, and then on September 24th, it came up with a third witness, and all of those three witnesses, which were discovered just a couple weeks before trial, were all testified, all those three new witnesses. So if we're saying people are being dilatory and the government's, even with all the resources, it's coming up at the last point in time too, I'm not sure.
First of all, I don't think the dilatory factor is outcome dispositive. The Kramer court didn't say one factor weighed more than all others.
Unfortunately, the judge relied on dilatory. Did the judge only rely on
dilatory? No, the judge also looked at timeliness, whether a new counsel was ready to proceed. He also indicated that the defendant has several cases.
Which counsel was ready to proceed?
Yeah. Oh,
just the state?
No, the new counsel was not ready to proceed.
When would new counsel? That was the question I had actually neglected or forgotten. You know, the factor that new counsel would be ready to proceed, and that was, I think, the situation. When would new counsel ever be ready to proceed in a case when the person hasn't even been permitted to step in yet?
I guess it depends when the defendant contacts new counsel.
New counsel had been contacted the day before the trial call, right, October 9th. And so, but on October 10th, the request to substitute was denied and continue was denied. Are you suggesting that the new counsel should have gone ahead and spent the entire weekend investigating and digging up witnesses, not knowing whether or not he would be allowed to represent the client?
I don't know what the court was suggesting. But I think if this court is going to weigh dilatory more heavily than all the other factors, which I think the record supports some of the other Kramer factors, I think if this court's going to weigh dilatory more heavily, perhaps judicial notice of the terroristic threatening case may provide some insight. But other factors was inconvenience to the parties. All the parties were ready to go, and so having to stop and start up again later is definitely an inconvenience. Whether the court also inquired or allowed new counsel to speak, and new counsel indicated that he was not ready, he hadn't interviewed the defendant yet, so the court took that into consideration, or that's in the record.
And counsel had not even spoken to the witnesses, the 10 witnesses that the defendant had asked him to contact.
Correct.
But Justice McKenna's point about the criticism of defense counsel and the fact that defense counsel hadn't been, I guess the issue had to do with whether the counsel is in good communication with the client, and in particular on issues having to do with witness preparation. That seems to be a factor that wasn't present in Kramer. Maybe it's a factor in this case that would suggest that there's even more of a reason to allow substitution in counsel here, where there's no issue that the defense counsel perhaps was not being diligent in the preparation of the case. So what extent do you think that makes a difference?
The defendant does claim that defense counsel didn't interview all the witnesses he gave, but when the court asked defense counsel...
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think he also complained that he wasn't really told about the new witnesses that the prosecution had come up with, and then defense counsel was standing next to him and didn't contradict.
Defense counsel just said he kind of evaded the question or skirted around it by saying there's no ethics complaint, so...
Well, his position was that was privileged, correct?
That was privileged, correct. Okay. So the state's position is that the standard is abuse of discretion, and whether the court clearly exceeded the bounds of reason or disregarded rules or principles of law. And in this case, Kramer hadn't been out yet, but the court considered several factors at the time, and some of it do relate to Kramer. And it didn't only rely on dilatory. Dilatory is not, I think, outcomes is positive. Other factors are supported by the record. And insofar as the court made those findings and the record do support some of the Kramer factors, I don't think the court abuses discretion, and the state would request that this court affirm the defendant's conviction.
Thank you. Any further questions? No? Any rebuttal?
Thank you. There were just a couple of things I wanted to briefly address. The first is this idea that there may have been things that happened in the terroristic threatening case that may have contributed to the court's finding that this case, the motion for continuance, was dilatory. You know, the court had the opportunity to put any evidence or any findings related to that on the record, and the court did not. The state also had the opportunity on appeal, if there were relevant facts in that case, to make that a part of the record on appeal, and the state failed to do that as well. And you know, if either counsel in that case or the defendant in that case had been acting to delay that trial, the question is, well, why did the court push this case to trial and grant motions to continue in that case? And I believe it was Justice Pollack brought up that the three witnesses who were placed on the state's witness list on September 27th all testified at trial. Well, there were three witnesses on the defense witness list that was filed on October 11th, and only one of those witnesses actually testified at trial. The other two did not. And then there were three additional witnesses who weren't at trial. And also to reflect the state of preparation in this case, or the pace at which this case is moving, on September 26th, the court asked the defense what the defense in this case was going to be, and the defense counsel said it was probably self-defense. And we know that that wasn't the defense that was actually raised at trial. It was the defense of misidentification was raised at trial. So all of this is coming together in an extremely short period of time.
And this was not only, if I recollect, not only was he charged with a Class B possible 10-year prison term, but there had been a notice of extended term, right?
Yes, this was a Class B, there was a notice of extended term, and he was subject to repeat offender sentencing with a mandatory minimum sentence of 3 years and 4 months.
So we're looking at a potential 20-year, we're looking at a mandatory minimum, and we're looking at possibly even consecutive because there's another charge, and this case is going fast forward at a pretty quick clip.
Mr. Jerome, do you think the what went wrong here is the lack of explanation by the trial court, or is it your position that no matter what the trial court said, that there should have been a continuance and an allowance of the substitution of counsel?
Well, I think the problem is with the record in the state that it's in on appeal, it's very difficult to tell whether or not the court actually abused its discretion because...
You're not arguing that the court did clearly abuse its discretion?
Based on what's in the record, yes, because the record to me says that the court considered one factor. The court didn't consider the reason for substitution of counsel. The court didn't balance any other factors. The court didn't ask for the length of continuance. The court didn't even ask what the state's position was on the motion for continuance. And I think that what Justice Wilson was getting at is, you know, perhaps the prosecutor would have agreed to the continuance, because the prosecutor doesn't want to go to trial in a case and then know that there's going to be an issue on appeal. The prosecutor may have said, you know what, he's got legitimate reasons for continuance in this case. It's probably better, instead of being short-sighted, to think about the long-term effects of denying this motion. And, you know, Justice Pollack brought up the point that, you know, as is said in Madigan, the defendant's perception of the fairness of the process and his willingness to acquiesce in its results depend on his confidence in his counsel's dedication, loyalty, and ability. The U.S. Supreme Court in Gonzalez-Lopez said, a court has an independent interest in ensuring that criminal trials are conducted within the ethical standards of the profession and that legal proceedings appear fair to all who observe them. And I think we need to ask ourselves what perception the defendant would have about the fairness of the trial in this case, looking back at the record, looking at the sequence of events, looking at the procedural history, in terms of the defendant wasn't given time to find witnesses to testify on his behalf. He wasn't given the opportunity to proceed with the counsel that he felt was best to handle the trial. The defendant, when the state came up with new witnesses, the case got continued. When the courts and counsel and everybody else decided that this case was going to go to trial before the other case, that's what was done. The defendant really had very little say in what happened in this case. And, you know, I think the perception the defendant would be left with in this case is that he was railroaded, that he was forced to try on a case that he wasn't prepared for. So we are going to ask that the court find that the ICA gravely erred in this case, that the circuit court abused its discretion in denying Mr. Reed's motion for continuance and substitution of counsel, and that this court vacate his conviction and remand the case for a new trial.
Thank you very much to both our attorneys here today. The court will take this matter under advisement.